All right, let's get started. Our host for tonight is Dustin Dwyer. Dustin is a reporter for Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. Can I hear a big shout-out for State of Opportunity? All right, very good. And without further ado, Dustin Dwyer.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Steve. So I'm Dustin. I want to first introduce the people we have on the panel. We have Tammy McGinnity. She is filled in at the last minute. We had Hillary Goldman from ISTE was going to be here today, and her flight was canceled. So Tammy was on the ball, and she stepped in, and she's going to help us out. We have Dr. Ann Thorpe, who's a 20-year veteran teacher, technology mentor, and professional development specialist. Sorry, Tammy, I didn't mention your professional qualifications. I just was so enamored by the fact that you would join us. I didn't even get to your professional qualifications. She works at Penfield School District and is a chair of the Michigan Association for Computer Users and Learning. So many of you know Tammy. And then, of course, Kim Dabbs, who runs WIMCAT here in Grand Rapids, West Michigan, Center for Arts and Technology. So we have great experience here on the panel, and hopefully all of you can chime in with your questions and comments as well. I realize we have a lot of educators in the room, so I'm probably the least informed person in the entire room on matters involving education, so I would appreciate any comments you guys have or questions. So we're here to talk about the digital divide in education. I work on State of Opportunity. We do a lot of stories about kids in poverty, kids who are disadvantaged in one way or another, sometimes through income, sometimes through through their learning needs, sometimes through their geography of where they live. But I think one of the things that I'm interested in talking about is we've talked about the digital divide in education plenty of times in the past. What does it mean today to have the digital divide in education? Is it changing with the rapid change in technology? Are we seeing rapid changes in how students are dividing in terms of how they're able to use technology in education, how schools are able to use it? So with that, I guess I wanted to start with you, Anne, with my first question, because you're a professional development specialist. One of your jobs is to work with teachers, and you go around to different schools. And what do you see in classrooms that you visit in terms of the difference in how teachers apply technology in the classroom? Do you see differences based on the type of schools you go to? What types of differences do you see?
Well, many of the differences come based on the technologies that are available within the school already. We're starting to see more and more of bring your own device to the classroom. However, many teachers are still in between. I'm comfortable with this, and I still need to learn quite a bit. So the state is providing a program right now through the Technology Readiness Infrastructure Grant where thousands and thousands and thousands of teachers are being trained to implement technology into the classroom. And this is helping also to bridge that divide, and through that grant also technology is being provided to the schools. So there is still a divide, but I think it's closing.
Okay. This will get to one of the themes that I think we'll probably touch on a lot, which is the divide between the hardware that's available, the types of actual technology, and the way it's used. So from your perspective, you see the technology moving into the classroom more, is what I'm hearing. Is the divide more about how it's being used at this point?
Yes, it is. There's still a lot of professional development needed. There is still a lot of need for the shift in professional development. If we're expecting our teachers to implement these tools into the classroom, then we should be using these tools in the professional development. And some of the styles as well, the blended learning, should be part of teacher professional development. Teachers should also have flexible learning opportunities, just like we're posing for our students.
So, Tammy, you also work a lot with teachers. You work for one specific school district. What do you see when you travel to? Do you work with more than one school within Penfield Schools?
I work with a K-12.
Mm-hmm.
I'm K-12. I'm the instructional tech coordinator, so it's my job to actually work with the teachers, and I do the training, and then I can go into the classroom as well, which, you know, shout out to Penfield Schools because they invest a lot of money in technology, and they also invested in a person that could actually help them instead of kind of, here you go figure it out. So I can go in there and I can hold their hand, or I can be just a helper, or I can do any of those things. And certainly that has helped us to get our professional development and our teachers a little bit more even.
So. Is that common for school districts to be able to have a person like you?
No, it's not anymore. Actually, when I first started, all four of the districts in Battle Creek area had a person, And I think I'm the last remaining person, although it's now it's going back up again. So they added another one of them added somebody this last year. So maybe we're getting to a point where they're going, oh, yeah, maybe we really do need that person.
Yeah. Okay, so now to you, Kim. You are a resident out-of-school expert. You work for an organization outside of schools that serves kids that actually get bused into WMCAT to take technology classes, right? So what do you see in terms of what's being the students who show up at your door? Are they technologically literate? Are they ready to take the classes that you guys are offering? What are you seeing out there today?
I wish they were. I really wish they were. Our organization focuses, on building a culture of opportunity for all of our students to make social and economic progress in their lives and community. Doing that with a tech education and utilizing a lot of really amazing resources that we have through a lot of community partnerships and the infrastructure we have in our building. But when the students come, they're not prepared. They're not ready. Of course, you're going to have some students that are, but bringing your own device or having access to these devices, our students just don't. And it's at varying different levels of engagement. So our program really focuses on some cool programs in the out-of-school time setting. We partner with Grand Rapids Public Schools, who's been an amazing partner for us, understanding that we need to build and bridge that digital divide for our students. So we offer things like mobile app design and development, video game design, programming, interactive design, all of these different, what we consider critically important languages and fluencies that our students need to know and have. But we're starting at square one. And the access to the technology just, we need to make leaps a lot faster.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's pretty amazing to have a place where teenagers can go and learn how to make their own app. I think a lot of schools would love to have classes like that. I don't know to the extent which schools do, but I mean, you're able to bring kids in, and when they leave the program, they're making their own apps.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that. I might need to hire some of your
I don't know
kids.
How to do it either, so the kids have to teach me as well. But what we do is we have a unique learning model. So we focus on a lot of people in arts education or design education understand when I talk about design thinking as a pedagogy. So a lot of times educators will talk about project-based learning where students can actually get that hands-on learning. We've switched to a hybrid of design thinking and project-based learning for our students because that methodology, that pedagogy really works for the students to really bridge that gap and to gain a lot of competencies really quickly. Through that design thinking process, our students are able to engage with the world around them. One of the most successful classes that we have, of course, is the mobile app design class, because what kid doesn't want to make their own app, right? So when we presented this to our students, in order to build that infrastructure, we were able to partner with a software development firm called Mutually Human that's actually working in the field and doing some amazing work. So we partnered with them as kind of a technologist in residence to come in and work with our students 2 days a week. We have instructional support in the classroom. Through this design thinking process, they were able to decide what's that one project that I want to have in the world? What's that one project in the community that I want to make an impact? And for them, it was engagement in the downtown area. So knowing that the students wanted to do that, we paired them with DGRI, or the Downtown Development Authority here in Grand Rapids, to work in cohort to decide what that app would look like. GRPS is obviously our school partner because we focus just on urban core teens. So our students are able to get high school credit, high school elective credit for the time that they're with us because of the alignment to state standards and the teacher that works with us at GRPS. We have a partnership also with Kendall College of Art and Design, and because of the rigor that we're offering, they offer dual enrollment credit for the students. So when we talk about that holistic education, we talk about the project-based learning, the design thinking, the community partnerships, the civic engagement while they're learning the skill and practical application. Some of the ideas they came up with for DGRI, which is incredibly applicable right now, is a pothole app. So while you're hitting potholes, you can have an app open to tell them where those are. So the kids
there might
come.
Be a texting while driving issue there that they have to overcome.
There would be. So the students are coming up with lots of different ideas, but that engagement is there. So all of a sudden, you know, they're coding and they're working. They're working within the field. They're seeing those opportunities for higher education. All of those things that are barriers to urban teens engaging in the community and becoming successful in that digital fluency, we start to remove those barriers.
Mm-hmm. Tammy, you know, at WMCAT, and I see this all over in Grand Rapids, we have a lot of foundations that are out there, a lot of resources out, the community resources out there that are stepping in. I know in GRPS schools, I think every classroom in GRPS has a smart board that was donated by Steelcase, I believe. So you have these connections outside of the classroom. How do you guys handle that in Penfield, where there aren't quite as many institutions around? Do you have to rely particularly on the traditional funding models through the federal government and the state, or do you have other ways that you guys are sort of getting resources into the classes?
Well, that is a good question. I want to dovetail off of what you said first, and I'll bet you every educator in this room is going to do a whoop-whoop. You just described our Shangri-La. I mean, wouldn't you all? I would die if my classrooms could be like that. And honestly, that's like our vision. And it's just so much slower pace in the public education of getting people there. So that is really awesome. With that, Penfield is kind of out in the boonies a little bit. We're one of the four major schools in the Battle Creek area, but we're the furthest north. So there's not a lot of foundations or companies or anything around us, but we do have a Penfield Educational Foundation that's tied in with Battle Creek, and we have been working with them quite a bit, and a lot of our teachers write grants. And they're smaller grants, but they'll get a couple of iPads. They'll get a few Chromebooks and just start building that up. So that's certainly one way that we've teamed up with somebody. McCall, got to give the plug for that. We give out grants every year, and a matter of fact, those are going to open up here in the next few days. So there's a $1,500 grant that teachers can write. Again, a couple iPads, few Chromebooks, things that they need to try and do the types of things that you're talking about. So there are places out there that you can get the money, but they're usually smaller chunks. So for Penfield, we built a new high school in 2005, I believe, and the fall of 2006 was when we opened that up. And so we had a bond there, and that gave us a little bit of an open door to say, yeah, let's do the one-to-one. Let's do it. Matter of fact, it was January before we opened it in the fall, and my superintendent looked at me and said, I think I want to do a one-to-one.
Can you, for the very few uninformed people in the room like me, can you just
absolutely
give me a definition of what a one-to-one
absolutely
is?
A one-to-one means that there is one device for every one child. In some situations, they get to take those home, and in some situations, it's just at the school. It depends on what they're doing, but they have their device. So my superintendent looked at me and said, I want to do that. And I'm like, oh, like, you know, the year after? No, this fall. So we got our act together real quick, and our 9th through 12th grade took us a few years to build it in, but they all have a laptop that's supplied by us, and they can take that home 24/7. We have a pretty robust wireless to handle it when they're there. And, of course, as soon as you have that kind of access, that opens up to a lot more of these problem-solving and the problem-based learning that you were just talking about, which is huge right now in education that we're trying to get to. So we had to start with the bond, and then when everybody was, like, hooked, then we had to figure out how to take it out of the general budget. You know, and that's where you say, well, here's the pie. How are we going to divide it up? What are we going to, you know, how are we going to still get these laptops and get these devices into the students' hands with what we've got?
So when did you start? You started that this school year?
No, our first year with that was 2006.
Oh, so it's been a while.
Yeah, so this is our 7th or 8th year. I'm not very good at math, evidently.
So at this point, I mean, is tech literacy an issue with your kids? I don't know a lot about Penfield, but you do have some low-income kids in your district. About a little less than half of the kids in Penfield schools qualify for free or reduced lunch. So do you see differences there based on where the students, types of homes that the students come from?
We do, and I think a lot of people make the assumption that all kids just know how to do technology. And that's a pretty big assumption. It's a poor assumption. I think you could say more safely that they're more comfortable with technology. They're not, you hand them an iPad or you hand them a device and they're going to do something with it. You know, a teacher, you hand them the device and they're probably going to be like, you know, they're like, I don't want to blow it up. Where do I push? What do I do? So they're very comfortable, but they're not very literate. They're literate on the things that they've been doing as they've grown up or wherever they're at, whether some of the kids that are more well off might have that kind of access, and they've already started playing around with making apps or Minecraft and doing servers for Minecraft and doing that type of thing. People that don't have those types of devices at home are, you know, they come in and they're really lost, and we have to catch them up. So
is that changing just in the last couple of years? Because in reading some materials, I mean, just really even since 2010 when smartphones have become adopted more and more, and tablets, I was looking at some of the statistics, and, you know, the Pew Research has done surveys, and it's, I mean, adoption of these types of technologies, just like 20% of homes with families that make less than $30,000 have a tablet in the home. I don't even have a tablet in my house. But are you seeing that sort of catch up a little bit just in the last couple of years, or is it still?
Well, one thing that we did find, because one of our biggest concerns was when we just gave that kid a laptop, they're taking it home, can they access anything? And we were very concerned about that. We surveyed the kids beforehand, and surprisingly, there was like 80% of kids said, oh, yeah, I've got something at home that I can do that with. When we gave them out, I was waiting for the parents to come in and be like, look, my child doesn't have access. What are we going to do? And honestly, we've had almost nobody come in and do that. It's really, truly amazing. And they will find places to connect. They will go to McDonald's. They will go to the library. They will go to their friend's house. So they get the access. They find it. So it's not so much that the divide is with getting the access and the that type of thing. It's really more the skills. And because for them to go find that access, they have to have a reason. And they may not have had that reason like somebody else.
So, Ann, what do you tell teachers? Do you work in some schools that are one-to-one or and some that are not, or is it pretty much all one-to-one?
Well, I'm at the county level, yeah. And the teachers usually come to me for professional development. I do have some instances when I go out to buildings, but it's not too often. I have to agree with what Tammy just said, though, about the divide being between skills versus access. So often I have teachers who say, well, I have kids who don't own anything. It's not about ownership anymore. It's about access. And access is everywhere. It's at Starbucks. It's at grandma's house. It's at the neighbors. It's at the best friends. Access is I know it's not everywhere 100%, but it's pretty much
there. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And then the same, I agree with what she said also about the issue of students. People think kids are tech savvy. Oh, they're fine. We don't have to teach them how to use the technology. They do know how to use it, but they use it for entertainment and socialization. They're not using it as a teaching and learning tool, and we want them to get to be using it effectively for their own learning and for the production of their learning versus just being consumers.
Well, what's the nuts and bolts of how you work with teachers on implementing technology? Because, you know, Kim described a Shangri-La where, you know, you get to teach about video games and making apps, which I imagine most kids are motivated to do. But when it comes to using technology to make them do their multiplication tables, you know, it might not be quite as exciting. So
actually, it is kind of exciting if you find the right way to meet the needs of the children. And the thing is, I have so many people come to me and say, well, what's the best thing for me to use? There is no best thing. You have to find the best thing for that child, not for that whole class. Just like, is everybody in here eating the same meal or drinking the same kind of beer? No, they're getting what works best for their palate or their style, their flavor, even their diet. We have to do the same thing in the classroom with student learning. We have to look at the students and look at what their needs are, not what my needs as a teacher is, but what their needs are. That's how I handle my professional development. My teachers come to me, and they want information. I let them lead it. They tell me what they need, and then I give them back what they ask for. So,
do you have any specific tricks you can share? Are there frequently asked questions in your line of work?
The most frequently asked question is, which app is the best? And I just flat out say, I'm seeing a lot of people going, yep, I hear the same question. I basically just tell them I'm not in the habit of recommending any particular app, but I will teach you how to find the apps that will work with your students. So I work with teachers to empower them and guide them so that They are fulfilling the needs in their classroom. I'm not fulfilling those needs because it is the teacher's responsibility, and it's also their job to find what's going to work best for their students in their classroom. I'm not in their classroom. I don't know their students.
But is that just another to-do item on their list? I mean, if a teacher has already, got a lot of a big workload, now you're telling them, do your own homework on which apps to use?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. And the way I factor my professional development is they actually do it while they're with me. Uh-huh. I don't send them home to do it. My philosophy with professional development is all of my participants leave with a tomorrow package, something they can do in their classroom tomorrow. So they leave with something that they put together while they were with me, and they can take it and use it in their classroom immediately.
And are there specific issues that are different when you go to schools that are in a more low-income setting than some of your more affluent schools that you visit?
Well, not really, because the teachers still have the device. Some of the questions I'll get, though, is, okay, I only have one device for my whole class. How do I effectively use that versus the one-to-one situation that Tammy described? So they all come to me with different questions, different needs. I mean, if I have 16 people in a PD, I have 16 different questions
right.
and needs
right.
that come in.
So back to you, Kim, and working outside of schools, you don't teachers aren't really coming into your building. You're sort of you're being farmed out to do some of these things. You have resources that a lot of schools can't get, and talent that a lot of schools can't get. Some of your instructors, I mean, I'm sure you have an instructor who has a degree in video game design.
He does. And we're not sharing him. No.
So, I mean, are you sort of fulfilling the role of, are you sort of serving as that class that the school can't provide?
Absolutely. I think it's a partnership. We are a community, and just like when we talk about design thinking, a lot of people know it as human-centered design or user-centered design, because at the end of the day, we are concerned and working with and teaching and being a part of the lives of each and every student that come to us. So we do the tech ed, we do the arts education, we have photography and screen printing and fashion design and illustration, and all of these great mediums, but those are the tools of engagement for our students. So at the end of the day, our organization, our mission is really to focus on disrupting that cycle of poverty for all of our students by making sure they get their high school diploma. We work with them to engage them in these different fields, but we're also providing massive wraparound services. So while they're making their mobile apps and while they're focusing on documentary photography or film and video, we're also calling home to their parents at least once a month just to say, hey, how you doing? I just want to let you know Tom's doing awesome in our class, and we're so lucky to have him. He just did this amazing, amazing project. Do you want to hear about it? We're working with the school counselors and the district to make sure they're on track to graduate. We're working with their arts educators and their teachers to see if there's anything that we can be doing alongside them. I mean, it truly is a community effort because each and every one of our students in Grand Rapids matters. And the world-class facility that we bring them to and the education that we give them is closing that divide. I always say I don't want to give them what everyone else is giving them. I want to give our students a competitive advantage, because at the end of the day, that's where the divide is, right? So it's one thing for every student to have a device. It's another for well-resourced districts to be teaching students at a very young age how to code so they're fluent by the time they're graduating and have a competitive advantage, where our urban schools don't have the resources or the ability or the capacity to do that. So I will, every day of the week, every day of the year, make sure our students have that access.
Well, do you have any tips for the educators in the room as to how to get the resources and that community engagement that you guys are so good at?
Yeah, absolutely. I say start looking at unlikely partners. So, you know, we talk about the Shangri-La model, but this model is being used by other people throughout the country, throughout the world. I mean, we believe strongly in professional development. Suddenly we're trying to understand at what point did we not believe that investing in educators' professional development is a benefit to each and every one of our students. We need to, at a fundamental level, as a community, say we need to invest in professional development to give them the resources they need. So when they're given an iPad or when they're given devices, that we know how best to use it and tailor it for each student.
So where do you, I mean, if you're a teacher, where do you look? Where do you even go?
You go to organizations like us. You go to your public libraries. You go to businesses. I mean, when you talk about tech, what tech companies are in your area? Because everyone has some, right? What are we doing to say, can you get involved in our school? Just like with literacy. I believe that the literacy movement in general has done such an amazing job of recruiting mentors into their classrooms. So people are coming in and reading to our students on a regular basis. But what are we doing within the technical education field? What are we doing to say, all of you innovators, all of you coders, all of you mobile app developers, all of you web developers, graphic designers, you need to mentor too. And this is our community, and together we can do this. And, you know, what if that hour of code was an hour of code in school, in our day, and all of those people that are working in the business community are coming in saying, yes, just like literacy is an important benchmark for our students at the third grade, that digital divide is a really important benchmark for us in the third grade as well. So help us get there. What can we do to pull in those extra resources? And it's not always monetary. So much of what we do is making sure that the correct partners are at the table when we know that we want to give the students that experience. And more often than not, people are bursting at the seams to want to help. So those traditional models, we need to relook at that. So just like you want project-based learning or design thinking, we need to relook at the way we deliver that educational model for students. And we need to relook at who's out there in the field, who's mentoring, who's working with our students, what kind of partnerships we can form.
So I'll say, one of the experiences I have had at reporting on schools, I spent a good amount of time at Congress Elementary here in Grand Rapids in the fall. And one thing I learned quickly in the classroom that I spent a lot of time in is that the days are packed. The curriculum is tight. I mean, they and their requirements about how much time they spend on reading, how much time they spend on math. The idea of doing code sounds nice, but Tammy and Anne, do you think teachers have time? Do you think they can fit those in their busy day?
You can learn math through code.
You think so? Do you guys do work like that?
I absolutely agree with you. I think that comes to the sometimes change is slow in public education. I know a lot of school districts that did the hour of code that was happening the last couple months here, and were very successful at that. The problem is getting everybody on the same page, number one, and the balance act between what we want to do and what we have to do, that's where sometimes it gets really mucky. It's wonderful to do that kind of thing, but we have to make sure, too, that they're going to score well on the test, and we have to make sure that all those things align, making the app and everything else are going to line right up, because if we don't get the scores, then we're going to get published in the paper, and we're going to get our finger wagged, and,
No one wants finger wagging.
No.
But at the same time, when we take a look at some other districts that are high-performing, whether they're public or charter, you take a look at high schools like High Tech High out in San Diego that absolutely takes a new approach. And take a look at their test scores, and they're off the charts. So when we talk about taking a new look at reframing the way education is delivered to make sure that digital divide is just completely obliterated, there are models out there. We just need to make sure that we're advocating within our classrooms and within our districts to say, this new model of education works. We have the test scores to prove it, because everyone wants the test scores, right? But that doesn't mean that the traditional class is going to look like the traditional class forever.
Sorry to interrupt. But
go ahead.
No, you go ahead, and then I'll...
I have to give my plug again for McCall. I keep changing my hat. I'm sorry. But really what you're seeing happen here in the next few days is helping with what you're talking about. We're about to have 4,500 plus educators descend upon Grand Rapids, and some of them are already here. And they're going to spend the next 2 days going to sessions to look at things like that, to look at people who have implemented those types of programs and take notes and watch what goes on and take it back to their schools and try to be the, you know, let's do this. So, you know, this is part of our job as McCall to support our educators, to give them that PD, to give them that motivation. So, you know, I really hope that some of that will happen from the next couple days. And I believe I even saw a couple sessions on making your own app. So maybe we'll get closer than you think.
Well, you know, what I was going to ask is, like, if we talk about something like the digital divide, how much are we talking about the achievement gap, which we also talk about plenty? I mean, is it, if you work in a school where the kids are affluent and they come into kindergarten already knowing how to write their name and write a few sentences versus a school like in GRPS where the kids come into kindergarten, they're starting really with all that stuff, are you just trying to catch kids up and you don't really have, I mean, is technology sort of an extra thing that we're doing? Or do you think it's all part of the same thing?
I think it's all part of the same thing, but also going back to what has already been said in both cases here is that a lot of this change is fear-based. What if it doesn't work? What if, what if, what if? What if we don't get the grant? What if we don't get our bond? What if the kids don't do well on the test? Then what's going to happen? So it's easier to keep doing what we've been doing than it is to make those big shifts and just throw out the what ifs and say, you know what, we're going to try. And I think that that's part of the big problem. I agree with you. It's all out there. It's there to be found. But what if we don't find it? Or what if our mentor doesn't show up? Or what if the kids don't do well? But what about our non-readers? It's all the what ifs and what abouts. And a lot of fear is out there in making those changes and striving to make those changes. And we can read all the research we want to. And, you know, oh, but that's not going to apply to my population, mm-hmm. kind of thing. So I think the education system needs to be blown up and start over again. You can lead us. You can lead us.
Well, we'll have a few more beers before we do that.
How many of you in here agree with me? See? Woohoo! We are McCall, right?
Tammy, you guys you just bought some new Chromebooks for your kids. I was reading on your blog. Tell me about that, and how do you use them in the classroom? What are you guys using them for? And is it worth the money?
I think I just heard a few of my friends go, oh, no, did he say Chromebook?
Uh-oh, is this bad news?
She's going to get on her soapbox. All right. I love my Chromebook. First, let me just explain that a Chromebook is a device that has a screen and a keyboard, but it only runs the Chrome browser system. So if you want to install Word on it, you can't do that. If you wanted to install, you know, Illustrator, you can't do that. It has to be something that's done either online or with an extension or an app, kind of like what you would do on an iPad. You can go to the Google Store and get some apps and some extensions that make your browser do more things. So we have had that laptop program 912 since 2006, and we wanted to start moving it down into the middle school, and cost-wise, that's a lot of money. So right about then is when the Chromebook started hitting the scene, and I actually bought one for myself for Christmas, not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before. I'm like, ooh, Merry Christmas, and I started using it, and I loved it, because I really thought I was going to use it and go, you know, it's pretty restrictive and you can't do this and that. Oh my, I love this thing. So as I looked into that, you know, the price point for these are anywhere from around $249 on up to a little bit more than that. But the average range is at $250 to $300, which is way different than some of the, like, the iPads
and that kind of thing. Cheaper.
You know, so it can be almost a two-for-one in some situations. So we decided to go ahead and do the pilot with our eighth graders. And we got a device for each child. They don't take them home yet because I think everyone, they're like, no, not middle schoolers. But I'm trying to convince them and get them there. But right now they come to school. They get their device that they have every day, take it around with them to school, and then it goes back in the charging cart before they leave. But the nice thing about that is because it's web-based, when they go home, if they have any access, they can get to all their stuff. I hope there's no one from Microsoft in here, but I really, I mean, Google, to me, this Google Apps that yeah. they're giving to us for free is one of the best things that has ever happened to education. The tools that has given us.
But what are you talking about specifically? Like, what kinds of apps?
What we get with that is if you all go out and get a Gmail account, you have your email.
The Google Drive and all of those
right,
things.
Right, right. So what they did to us is they said, hey, we'll give you your own little part of the umbrella here, and you can even have your at penfield.net instead of the Gmail, and we'll even give you some control over that area. Mm-hmm. So all of our students, all of our staff have a Penfield at .net email and Google Docs and calendars and all the things that go along with Google, and it's underneath that umbrella. And I can go into the admin panel, and I can do a lot of controlling there. I can push apps out. I can push extensions out. We found about a week ago that the 8th grade boys were, like, totally enamored with the Let's Make My Own Nike Shoe site. So we said, you know, let's block it for a couple days just to get them away from it. And then, I mean, it took me 2 seconds, and then we turned it back on, and there was something new after that, you know. So it's such a quick and easy way to be, and I could have never done that with our laptop program. So I cannot say enough good about what has happened with that program. And I don't know how many people out there have ever taught 8th grader, worked with an 8th grader, or had an 8th grader in your household, but how many times do you see them asking? They actually would come up to me. I've had several of them come up to me and go, thank you so much for this. This has been so great. I love it. And I'm like, I mean, I was an 8th grade teacher for 16 years. I don't know that I ever heard that. And I've had kids just come up and tell me stories about what's going on. And I've had teachers that are moving away from that old model, that are trying new things. And all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, I have my kids engaged when I do this and I don't do a ditto. And they're starting to get it. So just a wonderful, wonderful program. We're going to go ahead and move it down to 7th grade and kind of keep going. And as our 8th graders go into high school, we're actually, instead of giving them a regular laptop, we're going to continue the Chromebooks.
Well, like, what do they actually do with it in the classroom? Is it still the same lesson plans and they're taking notes on it? Or, like, how does it change the dynamic in the classroom?
Well, you know, and therein lies, I definitely want Anne to talk about a program that she's in called BLIC, because that's going to fit right in with what you say there. But just like everybody, your teachers are at different spots. Usually when a teacher starts with technology, they take what they've always done and they try to shove it into the computer. So there's not a whole lot of difference. And then they move up where they start trying things, and then it starts changing and looking different. I have some teachers doing wonderful things in their classes. I have a special ed teacher that came up to me and said, you know, we were having a discussion in our class about, I don't know, some animal, and these special ed kids said, hey, let's get the Google or our Chromebooks out and let's look it up. And they all of a sudden opened them up. They were all taking over. They all had a discussion going, and she just sat there going, huh? I mean, that just doesn't happen. So really a wonderful thing. So maybe you should talk a little bit about BLIC, because that's a pretty important program with that.
She is saying BLIC, not BLEC. BLIC is BLIC, and it stands for the Blended Learning in the Classroom Project. And I'm looking around the room, and I see many of our instructors in here. Raise your hands, please. You all asked me not to out you, but I am anyway. The Blended Learning in the Classroom Project is a grant funded by the REMC Association of Michigan and MDE and some other. We just suddenly got money handed to us to take this program statewide, and we were told, I say we, Melinda Waffle is my co-partner, co-project manager on this. Melinda's over at the Calhoun ISD, and we were voluntold to create this program. It's been about 3 years now, and we're on our fourth deployment of our session, and we are up to running 56 sessions right now. We have, 56 instructors. We have 23 or 24 sessions running. We have approximately 550 teachers across the state of Michigan learning how to effectively blend their instruction through our course that we wrote and put together. And our instructors are very highly trained. Melinda and I go out and we personally train every one of our instructors.
Can you tell me the blended model? I think I know what it is, but let's...
Well, there is no such thing as a blended model.
Okay.
There are several different types of blended learning. You can blend your day, where some students, maybe they take three
seat time classes, but they might take three online. So that's a blended day. They might have a blended class where they go to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and they do their online work Tuesday, Thursday, or it could be the reverse. Lots of
so it's sometimes
so that's a
like...
blended schedule. But then there are the use of blended elements, which many of our elementary teachers are actually doing a lot of blending through using blended elements. Just for, as an example of what Tammy was saying with some of the ways the Chromebook is being used, they're actually blending their instruction through engagement, collaboration. The students are continuing to blend through the use of the online tools and the face-to-face tools. So there really isn't one specific model. There are actually several. And it could change from day to day also depending upon what the goals are. I'm sure a lot of what you're doing in your arena is qualifies as blended as well. Mm-hmm. Putting a PowerPoint online and having the students look at it is not blending.
Well, this, you know, something I wanted to ask about because when we talk about blended learning, I remember a few years ago when GRPS started talking about going to the blended model, it was announced in the context of another, one of their transformation plans, and there was a lot of parents, a lot of people in the community said, this is not you trying to go to the online future of education model. This is you trying to save some money and not have to have as many teachers. So is that being implemented in that way in certain places? Are you seeing some places that are just like, well, let's call it blended learning and we'll have less teachers?
Well, I can't speak to the GRPS situation because I'm not over there. But
without naming names, do you see?
I've actually had some say, well, if we blend, then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the teacher can teach these kids. And then on Tuesday, Thursday, they can teach these kids. Basically, what they're doing is doubling the teacher's work. And my job at Ottawa and as a representative of blended learning is to say that's not going to work because those students who, I'll just use the Monday, Wednesday, Friday model, the kids come in Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, they're doing their online work. If the teacher's teaching another set of students, then when are they going to engage with their teacher? When is the teacher going to be taking the time and creating and working with them and collaborating with them and implementing? It's not a planning time on Tuesday, Thursday. It's work time where they're actually working with the students in that online world. I've brought this up to several of my schools, and they all just look at me and they say, never thought of that. So my job is to talk them out of that model.
Do they listen to you?
Oh, yeah. They do because they start to get the point.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you also see... I keep asking if you see a difference in schools between the schools that maybe have a more affluent student population versus a less affluent student population. Do you see more of the sort of cash-strapped schools trying to use blended as a way to save money, not as a way to improve learning?
No, not really.
You don't see a difference there?
No, mm-mm. Okay. I don't see a whole lot of that. Most of those who ask for help want that improvement in engagement. They want that improvement. They want to break, you know, the digital divide, and they want those students to have those opportunities and be able to move forward in the technological world as well as the educational world. If we don't start our students now, when they do get to high school or college or out in the work world, they're going to be very deficient in their skills, and we just can't let that happen.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask get to one topic quickly, and then we'll get as many questions as we can from you guys, but Tammy, you mentioned special education. It's something we haven't talked about a whole lot. What do you guys see as the opportunities for technology in certain student populations? Kim, I don't know if you guys work with many students who have learning disabilities or anything like that, or you know how you see these things applying. What do you see in terms of students coming through your door?
We find that they thrive because of the really high touch engagement. Having the ability to really focus in and work one-on-one. Also, the arts and technology are a unique way to give students a voice where they haven't found a voice before. So having that is kind of a lever of change in lives has been really successful for us.
Mm-hmm. And do you see a difference between your special education teachers and your general ed teachers or in how they apply technology?
Well, there are a lot of assistive technologies available also, and I see those being implemented a lot more. One of the things that I think that is really, really important is that technology or any type of learning should be tailored to the student's needs, not the teacher's needs. And it's the teacher's responsibility to do that. So, just for example, one of the things that I like to do is when I give an assignment, I tell them what I want the outcome to be, and I turn them loose, and they can submit and represent their work in whatever way that works best for their learning brain, and they represent it. Some kids might do a poster. Some might make a website. Others might create a video. Others might do a podcast. Some might put together a panel and do something like this and record it or make a video. And what we're finding is so many of those assistive technologies for special ed students are really good for all students. And that's one of the things that technology is bringing. I'm going to go to the Chromebook example. Students who have a real hard time typing, but they're very fluent in their speaking, can record their work and have it printed out for them, you know, speech to text or even text to speech, either way. For those students who struggle, either way, there's so many technologies to help. How many of you are Siri users in here?
Yeah.
Love it, right? We can talk right into our device, and it just types right out what we need to say. And having that in the classroom is huge.
All right. Well, I could ask questions all day. This is what I do for a living. But I would love it if anyone has thoughts on what you've heard so far, or any questions that we haven't touched on. I see one in the back, all the way in the back. Steve's running this. Good. Better.
My name is Jennifer Smith. I'm a play advocate. So it's interesting it's kind of a juxtaposition to the Learning Academy that my company put on yesterday to hear all this. But my question for you is, how young is too young for the initiatives that you've talked about today? You voiced your concerns that you had when you brought it into the middle school. Do you think this is possible to bring it into the elementary schools, or is that where you draw the line?
Well, I'll speak that a little bit. And how many people in here have kids that are under the age of 5 I'll even go further than that by the age of 2, they were stealing your phone and your iPad and using them? Absolutely. There's one sitting over there right now. There you go. She's got a tablet with her. I have a friend who's got a 5-year-old and five and 7-year-old. And when the first time I was using my iPad and she was 2 and she looked at me and said, "Mine," and walked away, I knew I was in trouble. I don't think there is a too young, but I do think with that, you have to be very careful of what is your goal. What do you want to do? What do you want the kids to achieve? If all you're going to do is put a bunch of apps on it and let them play, then don't spend that kind of money. But if you're really going to look at your program and see how can these tools help these kids learn and learn what they need to do better, then okay, let's continue the conversation. But I really don't think there is such a thing as too young.
I'm going to jump in on this one. Another thing that we do over at Ottawa is we hold sessions for parents on how to teach their students to use their devices appropriately. A lot of parents don't even know. And I think that that's where we need to start doing more parent education also. We held a parent night not too long ago, parent digital safety for parents. And I found it very interesting because approximately 90% of the parents there were parents of elementary kids, not high school and middle school, which is what I expected to show up, but it was elementary. So they were saying, how do I prepare my child for using these things effectively, whether it's iPhone, iPad, or any other smartphone or tablet? So I think that we also need to remember that as the adult in the household or in the family or even in the classroom, we have to put the limits on it. For them to have it in their hand all day long is not going to be effective learning. They need to talk to each other. They need to collaborate. They need to be able to still sit in a small group and be able to do something like this and that sort of thing. So I think we also have to remember that we do have to set boundaries and teach our children how to set those boundaries, and we have to monitor those boundaries.
Okay.
So I've heard a lot about apps in your talk, and I'm really curious to know how you discern and curate apps to place in the hands of the students that you're talking about. What is it that makes, in this sea of apps really stand out and educationally strong?
Well, one of the first things we do is look for free. But when I have my professional development participants say, well, what are the best apps? Well, again, as I said earlier, there is no best app. There is the app that I like to use, but my counterpart does not like that app one bit, and she likes something else. Both apps achieve the same outcome, but she uses the one she prefers, her learning brain prefers, and I use the one that my learning brain prefers. So what I do is I teach my participants, first of all, how to search appropriately for apps. There are so many sites out there that are going to tell you, best app for this, best app for that. I don't pay attention to those. I go through and you can go to the app store and search right under education. Just bring the drop down for education. Look at those and then vet the free ones and sign up for some of those free apps gone free and that kind of thing and vet those. Get the free ones, review it, try it out with your students and see what they gravitate toward. And then that's the one that you'll have more available. But at the same time, I might have 20 students in my classroom. I have 20 different learning brains. I might need 6 different apps in order to meet all the needs of my students. And so that's my responsibility to, if you have a district that locks down your apps, to go and say, hey, look, these are the ones that I need for my learning brains in my classroom. So it's a little bit of research. You got to try it out. You have to look at it. I mean, you can't be the herd just following the shepherd off the cliff.
My name is Carol Glanville, and I have a comment and a follow-up question. So is it Kim? Yeah, I wanted to respond to what you said about partnering between business and education, because I see that as quite a gap. I think teachers really don't know how to network at that level in that way, and I'm not sure businesses know how to reach out to teachers either or to classrooms. So I just wanted to mention an opportunity that's coming up here in the Grand Rapids area on May 7th, which is TEDx Grand Rapids, and the live stream event for education. And all teachers are invited to attend the live stream event. So you don't have to pay. You don't have to enter a competition for tickets because they're somewhat limited and it's somewhat expensive. So it's an opportunity for teachers to attend the TEDx event, and you can come with students or not. And if you need more information, please see me. But what I wanted to ask you was, aside from that, what are some organizations within the city, how do teachers connect with business and civic leaders to start those partnerships? Where can they go, aside from contacting maybe just like a specific corporation?
I always say it's content-based. So it depends on what the class is. It depends on what your focus is, what you're learning. We are a teen-led organization, so our teens really drive the direction of the social issues that they want to tackle for the year. While they're doing that, they're also the ones contacting the businesses and the organizations. They're the ones during that empathy and discovery phase saying, I wonder which organization I would want to work with.
Your kids do the pitch?
Oh,
your
yeah.
Teenagers?
They go in and they talk. I mean, all of these things are what we consider 21st century learning skills, right? So the students, when they decide, we've got some kids that wanted to affect homelessness. And it was one of those just heartbreaking discussions when you're going through that design thinking process to say, okay, what's the one social issue that you're going to tackle? And some of the kids really wanted to focus on humane education for animals. And then some said, this year I'm putting my foot down. We're focusing on homelessness. I've been there. I've spent time as a homeless teen. My family's been homeless. I want my voice to be affected in this change. So these are the organizations that I think that we can work with, that we can affect change in. We as educators sometimes think that we have to do all the outreach for that, but the outreach coming from the student is so much more impactful for all parties involved.
Sorry to interrupt, but where do you point them? I mean, you have those connections. Mm-hmm. WIMCAT has those relationships with a lot of businesses, but if you're a teacher, you just cold call your local bank? Or where do you send those kids?
It depends on, once again, the content area. So if we're working on financial literacy, absolutely. I tell the students to contact their local bank and talk about financial education because that branch manager is going to know who within that that bank, whether that be Fifth Third or Huntington. We partner with Huntington often to say, this is the person that needs to come in and talk to us about that. When it's environmental education, the students stick around, and we know that WEMIAC and Friends of Grand Rapids Parks and all of these agencies out there, the students are able to talk to and connect with. But these are vital and important skills for our students to learn along the way as well. So a lot of that connection can happen student to business. Especially, you know, I always say that the easiest way to open a door is when you're a student, because access to that kind of talent coming from a student, there will be, I mean, how many of you would be able to now in your professional career just say, hey, Pixar, I just wanted you to come talk to me. Not going to happen. But our students, you know, we have relationships, so the students were able to talk to Pixar. We've got HDVC, the High Definition Video Conferencing, at our space. So the students are getting an actual walkthrough of Pixar Studios because they're studying digital animation right now in their film and video class. All of these opportunities that technology lends to us really happens through, once again, that user-centered or that student-centered design of education. So we always drill right down to that student and really ask them. We ask them to make that ask.
I'm going to jump in here on that one, because as an instructional technologist, and we're talking about social media and so on, this is also a great opportunity for teachers and students to reach out through social media, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter. Also, the other thing, too, that I was a teacher for 20 years in the classroom, and my parents were great resources because, you know, I don't know if you guys remember that commercial where I told one friend and they told four friends and it became the, and so on and so on and so on. And that's what social media can do for you also, is reach out and find those people who are in California or even in Australia, across the world, who can bring you some of those through video conferencing and through Google Hangouts and all that sort of thing too. So I would say also, seriously, use some social media. And this is a great time to teach the students how to effectively and appropriately use social media as a teaching and learning tool as well, so that as they grow up, they understand how to use it appropriately and effectively. And then they're also learning how to reach out. As you said, these skills are so important, and take advantage of that.
My name is Leah Carpenter, and I am a Michigan radio nerd.
Awesome.
Welcome.
So when we talk about digital divide and the gap, how is getting more technology more important, or getting more help to use the technology? When I think about Congress Elementary, when you did the report, and the one boy that got upset because he couldn't read the book that he wanted to read. So where's the technology to read that book to him? So then he gets to read that book that he wants, and then get some help and encouragement on work on those words you don't know. So is it the technology, or is it the help to help him, you know, the teacher's assistant?
Well, I would love to talk about Jesse specifically, but...
you want to go?
That's kind of the old chicken and the egg question, let me tell you. And interestingly, you can see different districts do it in different ways. There are districts that will, you know, they have this bond money or they have this grant, and they just go out and buy, and then they try to figure out what to do. And then you see the opposite of schools that take a lot of planning and thought and then go buy the devices. So it depends on the school district as to how that happens. If you're asking me what I think is better, I think if all you're going to do is buy devices or technology, then you could probably save a little bit of money, because whatever you're going to put in, you better make sure you're supporting it. You know, and like I had mentioned earlier about Penfield being a very strong supporter of having a person in place that can go around and do those things. If you're just going to hand it to the teacher, it's going to go in a closet, and I've seen that happen. I've seen, you know, a teacher get a document camera, and I go in their room, and it's still in the box, not even opened, because nobody showed them how to use it. So there has to be a balance between the purchase of the actual hardware and then the support that goes with it. And you know, if you're just going to do one without the other, then you're probably going to be. I've seen people where they try to train teachers on something that they don't have their hands on, and so that's. That's kind of hard to do too. So it's hard to find that balance, but you do need to find a balance and not be at one extreme or the other.
I'll just tell you about Jesse, who also was in this story. He improved his reading scores quite a bit, and he is, I was told he's recently been getting some higher level books. He was a good reader. I mean, he was a good reader, and actually, but he just wasn't able to read Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which was supposedly above his level. But, you know, this gets back to something we talked about, and Congress has put a lot of effort into literacy and improving reading scores and things like that, and I can say that I think that in that classroom what I saw was they didn't have iPads yet. They just got two iPads for the whole school. He was improving his scores, and it was sort of low tech. Are there times when you have the option to go tech and you shouldn't? Yeah.
We have if anyone wants to visit our space too while you're here at the conference, you really should, so you can see how the space is laid out. We worked with a bunch of educational researchers to really build our space out and provide appropriate technology. But to us, what we consider analog technology is just as important as the digital technology. So you will see a lot of whiteboards, a lot of prototyping carts, things where students can actually get out, build materials, ideate around ideas. That is in tandem with the digital technology. Absolutely the formula that the students need, but they need that holistic education.
I'd like to jump in on that one also. One of the questions I get as a professional development specialist is, how do I know when to use an online tool or a technology tool versus the old-fashioned way? And my answer is, well, what's going to achieve your outcome the best? And as I said earlier, some students are going to want to do it a different way than other students. And we have to have that flexibility so that they all, number one, they need to learn how they learn. That's huge. But the other thing is try it out and find out, figure it out. We as teachers know we don't just walk in, we don't wake up in the morning and go, you know, today I think I'll do. We do plans, we do lesson plans, and we turn them in, right? And so trying things out ahead of time and figuring out, is this going to be the most effective way to teach my students? Is this going to be the most effective way for them to learn? If the answer is no, then don't do it. But you will find ways and things. And just as Tammy mentioned earlier, the teacher who was kind of guided by her students said, you know what, let's pull out the Chromebooks and let's find it this way. Let's look at this way. Let's represent this way. A lot of times in today's world, it's the students are leading the teachers just as much as the teachers are leading the students.
Hello. Thank you for your time in this important topic. My name is Connor Van Heitsma, and my question is, sadly, the digital divide is oftentimes based on zip code. It depends on where, in fact, you live. And I'm just curious, do you ever envision a day in which public education will be truly egalitarian, in which a student, let's say especially at the secondary level, the best calc teacher for them is perhaps at a different district, or even perhaps across state, in which that learner, because I hear a lot about meeting the needs of the learner and bringing them up to speed with today's society, but yet I also hear kind of that antiquated to a degree in district, in, you know, within those parameters. So I'm just curious if that could ever happen, in which each student is able to get out, in a sense.
Well, there's a new mandate or law on the books that just came in the fall, and it's called 21F, and I know some of you are going to groan. But what it is basically it states that a student anywhere from 5th grade to 12th grade who wants to take a course, just like you said, online or through another entity, by law, the school has to allow them to do that. Now, there are certain limitations and so on, which I'm not going to go into all of that, but those opportunities are out there. We also have here in Michigan what's called the seat time waiver. So now students are allowed to take up to 2 online or virtual courses in the course each semester. So they could take 4 per year through the seat time waiver and 4 through the 21F, so they could easily be learning with and through even other parts of the country
and with students who are from across the United States or even in the next room or the next county. So we are seeing more of that happen, but it's still, you're right, it is a lot by zip code, and it is going to take some time for that equity to take place.
Are those online programs high quality? I mean, he's talking
opening a new can of worms right there.
if his question is, can a student anywhere find the best calculus teacher? I mean, I'm thinking in my mind about all this move toward OpenU courses. I mean, I can go online right now and I can take an MIT course with a world-renowned expert.
Right. Well, we're not talking about those. We're talking about credit-granting courses. So could a student find a really well-designed, well-reviewed course? Yes. Could they find one that is not? Yes. So that's where the school does come into play. There is a team in the schools who, when this occurs, they help the student and the parent discern which is going to be best for that student. So, yes, there's some very poor stuff out there, but there's also some really high-quality stuff out there as well.
All right. I read an article in Mother Jones about the success of a virtual charter school, and it was in Columbus, Ohio, and the failure rate of the public school in Columbus was like 50% failure, so it was definitely a high failure. It was urban district. And they put in a K-12 virtual charter school, and it was an 80% failure rate within that model. So I guess my question to the panel, because in general it's been mostly a rosy-colored lenses take on education, I think.
Well, what about the part where she said she wanted to blow up the education system?
Well, she's in a county that's one of the richest in the state, so... But my question is, what is the panel's general take on virtual charter schools? Pro, against?
Do we have a take? I'll try to answer it for my part as a reporter who tries to ask these same types of questions. One of the things that I've found is they're kind of like what she said with the online learner. There's wide variation. You might find one in Columbus that has completely failed, and it's tough. It's one of the things that I hope to report on more, that we try to report on, is it's kind of sometimes tough to tell, because a lot of charter schools sometimes take over schools that were already struggling. So they're having a population of students that were already having challenges. So it's tough to say, you know, what effect they've had within 1 to 2 years, whether they can turn it around. Now, in that case, it sounds like it was a pretty clear case. But in my experience as a reporter, they're all different, and some might be good, and some might improve, and some might not. I mean, certainly the issue of charter schools is contentious, and you'll hear plenty of people with strong opinions about that. Do you guys have any other insight into that? I mean, you don't work at charter schools.
Well, one of the things, again, I'm going to go back to the parental guidance. If a student's in a virtual academy, then they're not going to a physical school. They might go to a physical site. We have a Michigan Virtual Academy, Charter Academy, right here in Grand Rapids, and people ask me all the time, how come the Michigan Virtual Academy is closed on a snow day? And I have to explain to them, because there's a physical lab for them to go to. But it's going to, again, depend upon the support of the parents, the support of the teachers, the support of the program. And again, I'm going to talk about teacher training again, because even just as teachers in the classroom have to be trained, teachers that are in a virtual setting need to be trained too. And it really is a different set of skills. It's a different set of knowledge, and it's a different application. And I think there's a misconception that, well, if you're a good teacher, you can be a good teacher everywhere. And that's not necessarily true.
Kim, maybe you have something to say over here? Kim's holding her tongue.
You know, I can come at this from a lot of different angles, and I'll come at this from just me as a parent. I've got 3 children. One of them is a freshman in college. So he's been through the K-12 system. And then 2 are just starting at kindergarten and first grade. Some, because of the differentiated learning that my son needs, I'll absolutely look to augment his education with online education. We've looked at Stanford. Stanford has a wonderful online education program for students. So we'll take a look at that and really kind of plug that in. But in no way... Do I feel that the education my son is getting could be strictly for my son a virtual education? I think that blended learning, that that combination of online resources, opening up a global classroom, absolutely necessary. Absolutely. Why would we not want access to anyone, anywhere in the world when expertise comes in many different forms? But for my son, I also want to build a community. And my son needs that community of peers. And that can only happen when he actually physically goes to school with his students and with that cohort. So I think the augmentation is the big difference.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you, I'm a high school teacher, and a lot of my colleagues are very resistant to technology, and you mentioned kind of fear before. How do you get people on board?
Well, sometimes it's top-down, and then the resentment comes in. I'm sure you see some of that. Mandated professional development often brings resentment. But a lot of times I'm very fortunate because as a professional development specialist in technology, there's no mandate like Common Core stuff that they have to come to my PD. So the people that come to mine are there because they want to be, so we have a lot of fun. But a lot of times what I see happening is word of mouth. Oh my gosh, look what I've tried, look what I've learned. And it's kind of a grassroots type of growing thing. But I think you mentioned the fear. The fears have to be addressed. We have to remember when I'm going to use a small child as an example. If a small child is afraid of something, we don't throw them into it. If they're afraid of a dog, we don't put them in front of a dog. If you do, never mind. But it has to be the same way with adults. Our emotions really aren't any different. Fear is fear. And it has to be addressed that way, too, that, okay, there is some fear here. Let's talk about that fear. What is it about? What is it about implementing technology and learning this is causing that fear for you and addressing that and then moving forward that way? That's how I handle it, and I find it to be pretty effective. I do have dropouts, though, I will say that. Not everybody makes it to the finish line.
Well, at my job, I actually have, that's a big part of my job is when I will go into a building, that's the wall I'll hit. I mean, just like anything, you have your early adopters and you have the people that'll come along, but there's always those people, that handful or sometimes more, depending on where you're at, that are just reluctant or downright, I'm not going to do it. And that, to me, that saddens my heart, because when an educator gets to that point, then, and they don't want to learn anymore, I almost you shouldn't be in there anymore. If you're a teacher not wanting to learn, then that's kind of scary to me. But that's a different thing. If they're willing, I can really get with them. And I tell a lot of people, I've got this one girl that says, I must be your biggest pain, and da-da-da-da. And I'm like, you are not. You're actually one of my I really enjoy it, because she will say that she's nervous. She tells me she's afraid to do it. She admits her shortcomings, but she tries it anyway. I mean, how great is that? And I'll tell them, I will come in there and I will do it right with you. I will do it first and then you can do it after. I mean, so having someone that can help you with that really helps. But I have found that when I find those people, the biggest thing I have to find is, what's their biggest bug? What is it that I hear them complain about a lot, or I see them working really hard on, and try to get them to say, hey, have you ever tried to do this and use this program? And if I can get them hooked a little bit like that, then we start moving down to a little better situation. But there are some that just refuse. And at that point, sometimes the top-down model ends up happening. But I've had a lot of luck being able to work one-on-one and try to find that, what do they need? What's going to hook them? And then get them in that way.
Hello, my name is Sam Marsh, and I'm a student teacher at Union High School. And around GRPS, we have a lot more affluent high schools. And the digital divide is something my students know about. They understand that they do have less resources than these other schools. And I've had questions like, why are other schools getting Chromebooks and we're not? Or even City has a lot more technical resources than we do at Union. How do I address these type of questions in the classroom? Because they can see this inequity, and it makes them feel worse about their school pride and their districts. So how do I address this in my class? How do I get them into your type of programs?
Yeah, send them my way. We do have kids from that school. And, you know, the best way that we found, once again, like the business partnerships, our students will go to school board meetings, and our students will speak up because they're not happy. You know, they're not happy that that inequity exists. And you can say and give reasons all day long, but once you start to empower the students to actually go forward and make those changes. And we had students from Ottawa High School that went to the board meetings and talked to Superintendent Neal and said, you know, we really want this type of course because we know this will engage us. We know this is the type of education we want. And, you know, she reached out to us, and we're going to do some kind of residency along with some of her teachers to actually be in the school in Ottawa. So I think, you know, that student voice is so much more powerful than we give students credit for. Actually empowering them to go and say in those board meetings with their families to say, absolutely, you know, Grand Rapids Public Schools, we have found, have been an amazing partner. And Superintendent Neal is consistently working not only within GRPS, but with organizations like ours and with the business community and with the philanthropic community to provide those resources. But I always say we don't know what we don't know. And our students don't know what they don't know. And as soon as they feel like they can find that voice to the work that they're doing and find that voice to be able to affect change, it's so much more powerful long term, not only for the district, but for the student.
Hi, my name is Jordan Cope. I work for the 61st District Court Probation Department. I have a lot of experience with poverty, with early youth to 17 years old, all the way through end-of-life clients that I work with. I'd like to touch on, I believe, Linda, you said you were the NPR nerd. Also, so am I. Mr. Dwyer, big fan. The piece you did on Congress was incredible. Thank you for representing
Thank
our city.
You.
Furthermore, Huffington Post put out a stat that was quite staggering to me. SAT scores with correlation to household income. If you look closely at the stat, under 20,000, the median score was around 400 or less. If you look at household incomes with over $200,000 per year, you're looking at a median income score of 600 or more. With such a huge income inequality, and with regards to education being first and foremost with young children, like Linda was saying, if they're trying to learn it when they're worried about finding meals at home, don't you think that's kind of a bigger issue? Don't you think that's going to impact education more? And what do you think are our social stances that we should probably do as a community to change that?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm grabbing the mic all the time. Those are absolutely the same things that we're fighting for every day. And I think within Grand Rapids Public Schools, too, that you'll find that they're doing the same things. The income inequality is absolutely a driving force behind the digital divide. And for us to think otherwise is just foolish. We understand the zip code issue. We understand where the funding happens. That's why we always talk about the augmentation and giving our students that competitive advantage. We just got funding to pilot a dual generation program at WMCAP because we understand that if the students are coming to us and we can provide them the education, right? We can give them an engaging pedagogy. We can give them a world-class facility. We can make sure they have the appropriate technology. But at the end of the day, if they're going home, and they don't have food to eat, or they don't have transportation, or if they don't have a parent that's working, or if they don't have a parent, period. You know, how are they going to stay focused, or how are they going to be able to really focus on the educational piece? So this dual generation piece is really talking about stabilizing not only the student, because we do that really well at WMCAT, we get them to graduation. We have a 93% graduation rate in a district that has less than 50. We know that our model works, but at the end of the day, we want to make sure that the family, too, is supported, just like you're talking about. KSSN, the Kent School Services Network, is an amazing partner in the Grand Rapids area. So if you're familiar with the urban school districts, in Grand Rapids, KSSN provides all of those services that you're talking about, because we know we're not just educating the child, that we need to take this dual generation approach to make sure the family is secure, the income inequality starts to go away. Obviously, on the other side of WMCAD is the part that we haven't talked about tonight. But we do adult career training to focus on career training in high-demand, market-driven fields to make sure that our students are making living wages with health benefits, that that cycle of poverty is completely broken, and especially when it comes to generational poverty. So KSSN, if you guys aren't aware, they provide amazing resources. So just like WMCAT with a dual generation approach, we're going to have a seated DHS worker in our facility because we understand that the population that we're serving, 90%, qualify for free and reduced lunch, that the majority of our families are on public assistance. Just like in those high-need schools, KSSN is also providing those services. So they have an embedded DHS worker, knowing that if the parents are coming in to really work through DHS issues and meet with their caseworker, they're also going into the school, and that school becomes a welcoming place in a community center. Many of them get their health care there. They have health care clinics and vision clinics. They have KSSN caseworkers there that provide access to and embed different social services and different community agencies to make sure that the families are supported, that there are after-school programs, out-of-school time programs, that there's GED training for parents. All of those things are absolutely necessary, and that's the only thing that's going to close that gap for the income inequality, because it is there, and it is the driving force behind that divide.
I mean, we obviously have many problems here in Grand Rapids, but it's my impression that we have also a lot more resources to attack those problems than many communities. You guys work, I mean, in Penfield, and if you're in Allegan County, I'm thinking you might not see as many services for parents to get their GED, to have early childhood education, things like that. Yeah, in Ottawa, okay. What about in Penfield? Do you have a lot of we're talking, I think, resources for parents at this point, because that's what's contributing here. I mean, it's one thing to have a Chromebook in the class for the kid from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., but when you send them home, are there services for the parents?
Well, we have, since we have done our one-to-one, we have had family-parent training built into that. When the freshman comes in, we have a freshman orientation that's a three-day event, and one of those days, the parents are required to come to that, and we do a whole presentation about that whole idea of what is this device, what is it not, what's it for. We try to educate them that device shouldn't be up in the bedroom with them alone, that you need to be supervising what they're doing and making sure that they're on track and asking them questions. So we do that type of thing, and it certainly helps. Sometimes it's not until some issue happens, and then when we address it, we can use that as a teaching opportunity as well when we start meeting with parents and things like that. So that's kind of where we're at with the parent support on that.
Hi, I'm back here again. Issues and Ale, Nathan Fennessy. I'm sure our host recognized me, but a couple things. Just one quick comment, and then I'll get to my discussion topic. We talked about one-to-one with the laptop and so forth. I entered Clawson School District over in Metro Detroit in 1999. They'd just gotten a technology grant, and they bought for every high school student a black and white Palm Pilot with no Wi-Fi. Yeah. And, of course, they sat in boxes for years, and they never got out. And I worked on my school's technology team, and we had a great auditorium remodel, and we got a lot of good technology out of it. But there was, a distance learning lab, never got used. And, of course, this was, I graduated in 2003, so this is over a decade ago. With the Chromebooks and stuff, it sounds like a lot better stuff, is going on now. I'm hoping all these, resources are getting utilized. Of course, back in Clawson, they had trouble passing more technology millages, early on the money had been kind of wasted. These Palm Pilots sat in boxes for years. And I was like, what are we doing with these? Oh, yeah, every student was supposed to get one. So that's my quick comment. My discussion topic was going on to, we have been talking about helping educate the parents and so forth. And myself, I don't have a college degree, couldn't afford to go to college, refuse to take out loans. There's a lot of people in their 20s. Of course, I'm almost out of my 20s now, but there's a lot of people younger than me, and they didn't have these Chromebooks books when they graduated in 04, 05, 06, 07, and so forth. And there's a big digital divide. There's this lost generation in their 20s now. And I try to go to GRCC. Okay, I did great in CAD. Oh, well, if you want to finish CAD, you got to go to Ferris and take all this and that. So that I feel like there's a big gap where these 19 through 27, 28-year-olds, kids that want to get access, and we've got all this technology now in the high school. Is there any way we can bring older kids in so they can get maybe Microsoft certified, maybe Cisco certified, you know, back through some kind of just, you know, we've got all this technology. Maybe we can put it to use for this little older kids. We didn't get this new wave of what's coming up now, and we still need help.
I think this is where maybe Kim says that WinCAD also does adult education.
We do. Yeah, we do adult career training. And there are a lot of initiatives within the Grand Rapids area to talk about that population. A lot of people call the population of the age group that you're talking about is disconnected youth. Some people call it opportunity youth. But it's really finding and removing those barriers to opportunity. We obviously offer training programs that are tuition-free, and there are other agencies, too. I always say that, you know, United Way is a wonderful partner. They've got a two-on-one service to say, you know, these are the things that I want to do, these are the courses that I want to take, but traditional education in higher ed hasn't worked for me. What are my options?
In the back room. I have a question. I am not native to Grand Rapids or West Michigan. I'm actually from the Thumb Peninsula and graduated 02, so definitely quite behind. But when I go back, I find there's quite a lack of technology, and it breaks my heart. And I would really like to know, how far is all of your reach? What resources can I take back home? Like, I have nephews and nieces in school, and I really would love to have them be technological, but unfortunately, the small little town of population, I think 3,000, there's nothing. How far is your reach? What can I do? Where can I go?
Do you know what ISD or REMC you're in? You don't need to say it out loud if you don't want to. But but your REMC has REMC directors, and they will help you. Anybody in this room, everybody in this room who's from the state of Michigan has a regional educational media center or an RESD. They're called all kinds of different things. But they will help you with that sort of thing if you get in touch with them. If you don't know who your REMC is, remc.org, remc.org, you can go and find out who your director is. Your ISD will also have resources as well, and it may be as simple as they offer some professional development, but they might have a technologist who might come out and help you and that sort of thing as well. And that's my role is REMC and ISD, and I work within Ottawa and Allegan counties, but I work with all the REMC directors in the state also. So, and we do have BLIC in your area of the world too. So
are you going to McCall?
No.
Okay, what's it? Yeah, I would say you can come show up tomorrow and you can register. You can walk right in and register. We'd love that. You certainly would go home with a lot of resources there.
Tell them Tammy sent you.
Tammy sent you, absolutely. They'll go, oh, great. But the other thing I wanted to suggest to you, too, is, and I don't know how into social technology and things like that you are, but, you know, as a instructional tech, I'm only one person in a district, and so I always have to find ways to educate myself and, you know, find that professional learning network where I can grow in what I know as well. And there's so many resources out there and so many people that blog and tweet and put things on Facebook or Pinterest. I mean, if you go to Pinterest and put in, you know, a topic of education that you'd like to do with them, you will find a bajillion things that you could do. So that internet access, if you can have that, you could find just a ton of resources for your niece and nephew and go that route as well. And I'm looking for you tomorrow.
Okay, I think we're going to have time for one more question.
All right, last one.
As I've been sitting here, I'm an instructional technology specialist as well. And I've heard a lot of things. I'm from the Flint, Michigan area. Inner city, yeah, whoop, 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 all that good stuff. And what I hear is, why do we have a divide? But the other thing, I go back to when I used to sell cell phones, and you can go into the brokers of areas and find the best devices. So when you start to ask, and well, our kids, they don't have this and they don't have that, that might be true. But I think the biggest problem, they don't know how to use with what they have. As well as we talked about, we're in a transitional point for the parents and the students to understand how to use those resources as well. It's great that we're here in Grand Rapids. And when I say we, I'm talking about Michigan Association for Computer Users for Learning. If you don't know what that's about, figure it out. Come check it out. I guarantee you, you'll learn something. The parents need to know about it. The students, it is a great opportunity, a great resource for all of Michigan to tap into. We talk about what tools could we learn online. Well, guess what? If you network with enough people, they'll tell you what's going on. If you ever had a question, the biggest joke is it's an app for that. Or Google it. Really? Yes. So how do you educate a parent that has a smartphone but doesn't know how to get such and such? Google it. So they're using some type of resource, but they don't think about that in the classroom because the system has says, ooh, don't bring that to us. That's a scary thing. We don't know if you know how to use it. Could be true. So that means we have to educate ourselves and shift gears. The only way that the inner city is going to start to get it, I loved it when you kept saying, train your students to speak for themselves, to have a voice, to know what has value. I guarantee you, if you ever have students do a showcase or come to a conference like this or go to the senators and things like that, I used to take special ed students all the time to Lansing to showcase. And then I would ask them when they're going through there and the senators are looking, it's like, wow, they're so engaged. I said, by the way, I have some special ed students. Can you point them out? No, because they were using a tool to help them to achieve the goal that they were going forth to do. It wasn't that the tool cost a bunch of money. Most of the stuff that I had with my kids were old, broke down, or whatever, and we knew how to manipulate with what we had because I networked with people that taught us how to maximize on that tool. If it's just your smartphone, you know, teach them how to get to something. They can get to that next point. Come to a conference like this and network and start to find out, well, how are you guys doing this? Would you guys mind coming and networking and showing our kids how to do this? Myself, I've trained all over the state, and I love to go into the brokers of broke areas to show people how they can refuse to be poor anymore. So thank you guys for being on the panel. Thank
Amen,
everyone
brother.
For allowing us to be here.
Thank you, Ron.
I don't think any of us could set it that well. Thank you. Thank you so much. I think that's a great way to end. So thank you, everyone, for coming out. Tammy, Ann, and Kim, thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for being here. I hope you have a great conference at McCall. McCall?
McCall.
McCall. So have fun. And if you're not at McCall, go check it out. Tammy sent you. Thanks.